people watching. Not that I'm nosy, I just enjoy watching people, especially at airports. And one thing that I find fascinating at airports are reunions. I like to see people saying hello, greeting one another, and even hugging one another. And yet saying goodbye can be just as moving. And nothing brings the human condition in us quite like greeting one another or even leaving one another. Now, speaking of reunions, I heard about a special class reunion that took place. He was a widower and she was a widow. They had known each other for a number of years, being high school classmates, and having attended class reunions over the last 40 years without fail. This anniversary of their class, the widower and the widow made a foursome with two other singles, and they hung around together at the same table. They had a wonderful evening. Their spirits were high. The widower throwing admiring glances across the table, and the widow smiling coyly back at him. Finally, he picked up the courage to ask her, "Will you marry me?" About 6 seconds of consideration, she answered, "Yes, yes, I will." And so the evening ended on a happy note for the widower. But the next morning, he was troubled. Did she say yes or did she say no? He couldn't remember. And try as he would, he just couldn't remember. He couldn't recall. So he went over the conversation of the previous evening, but his mind was blank. He remembered asking the question, but for the life of him, he could not recall her response. And so with fear and trepidation, he picked up the phone and called her. First, he explained that he couldn't remember as well as he used to. Then he reviewed the past evening. And as he gained a little more courage, he then inquired of her, "When I asked you if you would marry me, did you say yes or did you say no?" "Why, you silly man, I said yes, yes I will, and I meant it with all my heart." The widower was delighted, and maybe he felt a little bit of a skip of a beat in his heart. And then she continued, "And I am so glad that you called because I couldn't remember who asked me." So this evening we're gonna see a tearful reunion, a reunion of the two brothers who haven't seen each other in over 20 years. In chapter 33, verse 1, "Now Jacob lifted his eyes and looked, and there Esau was coming, and with him were 400 men. So he divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and the two maidservants. And he put the maidservants and their children in front, Leah and her children behind, and Rachel and Joseph last. Then he crossed over before them and bowed himself to the ground 7 times until he came near to his brother." Now, I love Western movies, and one of my favorite movies is The Magnificent Seven. And it's mostly a guy thing, perhaps. But there's a scene where all of the 7 hired gunfighters are riding to go meet the bad guys. And that's when the catchy theme song starts playing. And as a boy, I just love that. I really enjoy that very much to the point that I still enjoy Westerns, you know, 20 years later. So here I can picture Esau coming down with his men, all 400 riding, right? And you could imagine the scene, like the Magnificent Seven song, the theme song's playing in the background. And so, oh wow. Special effects, I didn't expect that. Thank you so much, appreciate that, okay? So this is in 3D. So I can picture Jacob lifting up his Stetson, looking up in the distance for a second. He's squinting like my main man, Clint, and maybe even spitting his chew. Jacob looks up and sees that it's none other than his brother Esau coming towards him with 400 men. Jacob divides at this time his family in the order in which he shows his affections. He divides his family into 3s, the maids and the children first, followed by Leah and then Rachel, with Joseph, the baby, his favorite, last. No doubt, Jacob was preparing for the worst. It's interesting, he had just wrestled with God, and now he was ready to wrestle with his brother Esau. And so Esau ran to meet him and embraced him in verse 4 and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. And he lifted his eyes and saw the women and children and said, "Who are these with you?" So we said, the children whom God has graciously given your servant. Then the maidservants came near, they and their children bowed down. And Leah also came near with her children, and they bowed down. Afterwards, Joseph and Rachel came near, and they bowed down. So Jacob was expecting trouble. What he did not expect is what he got. What he got was his brother Esau had turned into a big teddy bear. And the surprise that he gets is that his brother runs to him and hugs Jacob. So you could imagine at first the trepidation that Jacob felt. He probably thought when he saw Esau and his 400 men, he probably thought to himself, I'm toast. I am done. But Esau didn't come to kill him. He came to greet him as a long-lost brother would. And so they had a tearful reunion. It is said that they wept on each other's necks. They hugged each other. They cried. They probably kissed each other. And what a wonderful reunion that was. Folks, when we're in conflict with someone, the best way to approach them, to reconcile with them, is through humility and contrition. Remember, it takes one person to forgive, but it takes two people to be reconciled. And as the two brothers wept, Esau saw Jacob's wives and children. He asked Jacob, so who are those people? Who's that with you? And Jacob tells him, that's the children whom God has graciously given your servant. The faithfulness of God to his servants is illustrated here so clearly in this story and how the Lord answered Jacob's prayer and changed his brother's heart from wanting to kill him. And so Jacob then introduces his wives and children to Esau. And they all show respect to Esau by bowing down to him. So bowing down to someone in that culture is a sign of respect. And so Esau got the respect that he deserved. Then Esau in verse 8 said, What do you mean by all this company which I met? And he said, these are to find favor in the sight of my Lord. But Esau said, I have enough, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself. Remember last study that we were together last year, we saw that Jacob tries to butter up Esau by sending wave after wave of animals and flocks and sheep and donkeys and all that stuff, right? So that's what Esau is referring to. And Esau asked him about that. And so in all probability, Esau already knew what the meaning was, but he was perhaps asking Jacob for more information. What's exactly, tell me the truth, you know, fess up, what is the meaning of this? And so in accordance to ancient custom of the day, Jacob insisted on his brother taking his gift. Accepting a gift, you see, from one's enemy was improper in their culture. So if Esau did accept a gift, it was a sign signifying that their differences have been put aside. In other words, they had buried that hatchet and not on each other. And so it turns out that Esau didn't want any of that, however. He had plenty. The Lord had really had blessed him. It could be, at this point, some commentators believe that Esau may have had more material wealth than his brother Jacob. So Esau tries to talk Jacob out of giving him such a generous gift as the 500 animals. But to Jacob, this was a small price to pay in order to have peace and reconciliation with his brother. And in verse 10, Jacob said, no, please, if I have found favor in your sight, then receive my present from my hand. Inasmuch as I have seen your face as though I had seen the face of God, and you were pleased with me. Please take my blessing that is brought to you, because God has dealt graciously with me, and because I have enough. So he urged him, and he took him. Jacob insists that it was a present for him as a sign, because to him, his brother Esau was a sight for sore eyes. To Jacob, seeing his brother was seen like the face of God. Now, was he trying to butter his brother up? Or could it be that it's an expression such as, you're a sight for sore eyes, or I'm so glad to see you. You see, God, when Jacob wrestled God, God was pleased with him. And now he sees that there's peace between Esau and him. So now he thinks, hey, I've seen the face of God. It reminded me of that occasion when God was pleased with him. We see then that it's more blessed to give than to receive. And Esau finally gives in and takes the gift. In verse 12, Esau said, let us take our journey and let us go, and I will go before you. So Esau wants to go with him. He wants to travel together with his brother. They haven't seen each other for 20 years. Can you blame them? But Jacob said to him, he's not so sure that this was not a ruse. My Lord knows that the children are weak and the flocks and herds which are nursing are with me. And if the men should drive them hard one day, all the flock will die. Please let my Lord go on ahead before his servant. I will lead on slowly at a pace with the livestock that go before me, and the children are able to endure until I come to my Lord and Seer. And Esau said, now let me leave with you some of the people who are with me. But he said, what need is there? Let me find favor in the sight of my Lord. So Esau returned that day on his way to Seir, and Jacob journeyed to Sukkoth, built himself a house, and made booths for his livestock. That means corrals, pens. Therefore, the name of the place is called Sukkoth. For whatever reason, obviously, Esau wants the brothers together. But Jacob would have none of it. He uses the excuse that they have jet lag, that the camels and the flocks were tired, even the cattle had babies to nurse, and which could have been true. However, Jacob knew that they needed time to rest, and he wanted to delay so that he would find out whether his brother was setting him up or not. Jacob's reasoning, while true, was more than an excuse because he suspects the trap. Esau, on the other hand, he's legit. In fact, he wants to leave some men with him to take care of him, to help Jacob. Once again, Jacob is suspicious and doesn't want any of that. He wants to travel alone. Esau leaves Seir, which is translated hairy or shaggy, which is very interesting because you remember that since the womb, Esau was known for being a hairy dude. He was born with lots of red hair. Imagine Yosemite Sam being born. That's what I picture. So as soon as Esau returned to Seir, Jacob went the opposite way towards Sukkoth, which was located further west than he was supposed to. So what happened? Why did Jacob lie? Why did Jacob tell Esau that he would be right behind him when he had no intention of doing that? One commentator commentating on this issue said, What did Esau think when he realized that Jacob was not coming to Seir? Esau, who was kind, generous, and forgiving, shows up far better in all the details of the account than did his brother who had seen the Lord. Unquote. It's true. Esau must have wondered about his so-called favored brother who talked freely of spiritual things, but now was behaving worse than a heathen. There's a difference, right, between cabbage and diamonds. We all know that. Diamonds are beautiful and they're rare. Cabbages, on the other hand, are common. Yet a cabbage is something that a diamond will never have, real life. And we could say that this was the essential difference between Esau and Jacob. Esau may have been more outgoing, generous, likable, and manly and honest than Jacob, but Esau lacked something. He did not have a relationship with God. Now, there may be some of us who are troubled because perhaps we're not the most popular, the most athletic, the most handsome, the most beautiful, have the most hair or any hair, could be the richest. All of that is superficial. You see, popularity won't get us into the kingdom of heaven. Athleticism doesn't count in heaven because we're going to have new bodies. We don't have to worry about, do I have a bad hair day today? We're not going to be concerned about that. We're not concerned that it's turning white. We're not going to be concerned that it's all in the drain. None of that is going to matter. Beauty, we're not going to be concerned about, am I wearing the right makeup, the right shadows, the right lipstick for those of you ladies? Because beauty only lasts until the wrinkles come and stay, and they bring the relatives with them. But in heaven, we're going to have a new body. Okay, we're not going to be worrying about that. It's going to be perfect. As far as possessions, when you die, relatives will fight over them because you can't take the U-Haul with you, right? What ultimately counts, then, is how we respond to the gospel message. Jacob continues his trek to Sukkoth, where he built a house for him and corrals for the livestock. And so Sukkoth, incidentally, means booths or tents. He moves to tent city, basically. Jacob and his family probably lived in Sukkoth about 8 to 10 years because it was good grazing land for the herds, for the animals. Jacob had a relationship with the Lord, and yet he's going to make mistakes, just like we have a relationship with the Lord, but yet we make mistakes too. Then Jacob, in verse 18, came safely to the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, when he came from Paddan Aram, and he pitched his tent before the city. And he bought the parcel of land where he had pitched his tent from the children of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money. Then he erected an altar there and called it El Elohe Israel. Jacob comes to Shechem, which is about 20 miles east of the Jordan River. It's the same place where Abraham first came to when he came into the land of Ur of the Chaldeans in Mesopotamia. Jacob buys a parcel of land for 100 pieces of money, which is something that was weighted out, and we have no idea whether they use shekels or another form of currency. Jacob chooses to make a home for his family and herds in Shechem once again, and which means back or shoulder. Shechem was a city located near Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal. It was here that the men of Israel stood and shouted the blessings for obedience to the law of Moses, and Mount Ebal, where they shouted the curses on Israel for their disobedience to God's law. So it was a very prominent place. Shechem was near the northern kingdom of Israel, Samaria, when the kingdom was divided. Jacob there dug a well, which is still in existence, and you could still visit today. Shechem was where Jesus also met the woman at the well. Remember that, the Samaritan woman? So it's a very prominent place. But yet, this move would be very costly, as we're going to see later. Because Jacob, like one of his ancestors before him, you remember Lot, makes a very unwise mistake. He goes to live near pagans. Same thing that Lot did. Jacob is the first of the patriarchs to build a house for himself and his family. You might be saying, good for him. He has what we call the American dream. That is a home with a white picket fence and a quiet cul-de-sac, right? Basketball court on the outside. But there's a problem. God told him not to go near those cities. Genesis 31:3 said, then the Lord said to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers and to your family, and I will be with you. Remember that? So Jacob was supposed to go back to the land of the fathers, but he doesn't do that. And that's going to come back to pay him back. Jacob was not a sojourner like the other patriarchs were, but was a settler. And as if there's every indication that he intended to settle down here for some time. He should have returned to the place where he saw the vision of the ladder that reached down from heaven to earth. Here we see that Jacob was trying to be both Jacob and Israel at the same time, which is impossible. That's to say, as the name suggests, Jacob was supposed to be a new man, a new creation, somebody who had a relationship with God. And Jacob, we find, stopped short of where he was supposed to be. Does that sound familiar to any of us? Are we where we're supposed to be in our relationship with the Lord? We are either walking with God or not. If we're straddling the fence, that means we're not walking with God. If we want to be Christians but still acting like and chasing the world, then we're not where we're supposed to be. What we find then is that Jacob, the last verse of this chapter, builds an altar there and gives the name of El Elohe Israel, which means the mighty God of Israel. It's interesting that he builds an altar, and we may think, yeah, that's cool, right? That's a good thing. But it's obedience that God is interested in. He wants obedience first and not sacrificed. And Jacob's going to bear bad fruit because he's in a place he shouldn't be. And the result will be tragic consequences. We're going to see next chapter. Chapter 34 now. In this chapter contains one of the most shameful incidents in Israel's history. A terrible crime gets committed against Dinah, the daughter of Leah. But the response by Dinah's brothers are even worse than the crime. It's interesting that when the Bible shows its leaders and heroes in such terrible plain truth, we can know for sure that it is a book from God, because men don't normally write about themselves and their ancestors like this. The Bible doesn't hold back, and we're going to see that. Verse 1, chapter 34. Now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had born to Jacob, went out to see the daughters of the land. There was a reason God didn't want his people consorting with the Canaanites. The Canaanites were a group of people that were pagan to the core. Their religion was sensual, full of fertility rites that relied on sexual things. Young and married women in a Canaanite society were fair game in that Canaanite society. There was no moral code that forbid men from taking young women. It was part of their faith, part of what they practiced. And so Jacob erred, first of all, by moving there, and then compounded the problem by letting his daughter go into town unsupervised. At this point in time, Dinah must have been 15 to 16 years of age, which in that culture was an age that was measurable age. Most girls got married at that age. Dinah was like most teenagers. She wanted to go out, meet some friends, girls of her own age. But there's a big situation here that she was supposed to be different. She was not supposed to go out and be part of them. She wasn't supposed to be part of the world. Now, we see in our society that Christian kids complain that they're not allowed to have fun. Especially, that's what my kids tell me. They can't go to dances. They can't go to parties. And they say, well, kids from church are going to be there. They're going to be at the dance. They're going to be at this place. Now, does that make it okay? The big question, is Jesus welcome at that party? Is Jesus welcome at that dance? Dinah may have gotten over some lot of objection for her parents, but if so, I'm sure they thought her parents, she may have thought her parents were out of touch and only wanted to ruin her life. And those of us who have teenagers at home, that may sound familiar. Dinah thought that she could probably protect herself. And once again, there's nothing new under the sun, right? All kids don't think nothing bad's ever going to happen to them. I don't know if you ever heard about the marshmallow experiment. The marshmallow experiment is this. Psychologists placed a single marshmallow on a table in front of a child, and they said they had to leave the room for a minute. The child was promised two marshmallows if the first one was still on the table when the therapist returned. Researchers at Stanford University did this test back in the 60s. And a dozen years later, they found the kids who grabbed the single marshmallow, they tended to be more trouble as adolescents. The one marshmallow kids also scored an average of 210 points less on ACT scores. Learning to delay gratification is important. Dinah was a one marshmallow kid for wanting to go into town to hang out where it wasn't safe. That doesn't excuse what happened to her, though. Shechem was, we're going to see, was also a one marshmallow kid. So we find then when Shechem, the son, verse 2, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, prince of the country, saw her, he took her and lay with her and violated her. He raped her. His soul was strongly attracted to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the young woman and spoke kindly to the young woman. So Shechem spoke to his father Hamor, saying, get me this young woman as a wife. Now, this one commentator says this. This occurrence serves to illustrate the low standards and morals prevailing among the Canaanites. Any unattended female could be raped, and in the transactions that ensued, neither father nor son feel the need of apologizing for or excusing what had been committed, unquote. Jacob's lack of attention and protection was partially at fault in this tragedy. His own compromise made him less able to stand up to his own children and guide them as he should. And so what happens then is that this young woman was not looking for that kind of trouble, but the trouble came to her and she got raped. Our kids don't know the dangers of the world system and how empty a world system can be. The temptations of the world are shiny and fascinating, but underneath that bait is a very painful hook. Many of us know kids who grew up in a Christian home, came to church, went to youth group, and now are living it up in the world. How did they get there? They're probably not saved. They probably were not saved to begin with. They could have raised their hands to receive Jesus, but it never went to the heart. And that's some of the things that we're seeing. And so if they're living like unbelievers, probably because they never were. As painful as this sounds is that this father, Jacob, compromised by moving his house, moving his family in close proximity to the world. And so don't be surprised that if your son or your daughter hangs out with pagans, that she turns out to be a pagan. Parents, when we compromise, it affects others, and some with very serious consequences. This young woman was violated, and yet this kid, Shechem, it's interesting, the name of the town is Shechem. He's named Shechem. I don't know if the town was named after him or him for the town. Nevertheless, he says his soul was strongly attracted to Dinah, and he was in love with her. No, he wasn't. That was lust. He was in lust with her. In verse 3, we see that Shechem was strongly attracted to Dinah and spoke kindly to her. That begs the question, why would he rape her if he was so nice and really had feelings for her? The feelings he had for her obviously was in love. He talked sweet so he could get close to her, but when he got into a compromising situation, he took advantage of her. This goes on today. Yes, ladies, some guys will say whatever they have to in order to get what they want from you, but that's not really love. And yet, some women still fall for it, for the fear of being alone or perhaps some other reason. We could say that Jacob was a one marshmallow kid too. And as adults, we can be just as bad when it comes to wanting things. In fact, it can be worse because the toys become more expensive and the number of people affected tends to be larger. We see that Jacob was making decisions without prayer. We shouldn't be making the same mistake either. Now, the next bad reaction was that Jacob didn't seem to be angry enough about the rape of his daughter. Instead of taking the lead or taking control of the situation, he waited until his boys got home, and then he let him take charge. Now, if you're a father, if you're a dad, what would you do if your daughter got raped and you found out about it? And you knew who it was? I don't know about you, but forgive me, but I would be like Dirty Harry wanting revenge. And some of us probably would feel the same way. But yet, we see that Jacob doesn't have that reaction. In verse 5, and Jacob heard that he had defiled Dinah, his daughter. Now his sons were with his livestock in the field, so Jacob held his peace until they came. I don't know about that. I would have been a volcano erupting all over the place. Verse 6, then Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out to Jacob to speak with him. And the son of Jacob came in from the field when they heard it, and the men were grieved and very angry because he had done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, a thing which ought not to be done. But Hamor spoke with them, saying, the soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him as a wife and make marriages with us. Give your daughters to us and take our daughters to yourselves. So you shall dwell with us and the land shall be before you. Dwell and trade in it and acquire possessions for yourselves in it. So Jacob hears about the rape and he holds his peace until his kids get home. Jacob is not only the father of Dinah and the boys, but is the leader of the family. Jacob doesn't take action. He's what we call a passive father, passive aggressive perhaps. And what happens as a result of him not taking action is translates to the wrong action by his sons, because his sons now, they want revenge. Jacob has abdicated his responsibility by his passiveness, by his passivity. He's almost like an absentee father. Men, we're charged with taking charge of our families. We cannot, as fathers, for those of us that we have kids at home, we cannot be passive wallflowers. We are responsible for leading our families. We're not only responsible for putting bread on the table and protection from physical dangers, but we're also responsible for their spiritual protection and making sure they're fed spiritually. It's not something that we can afford to hand over to mom. That is our responsibility, men. In a Christian home, as the dad goes, the family goes. That is, the spiritual climate in the home is determined by the leadership of the father. If you were to have a spiritual thermostat, what reading would it give? Three readings: cold, warm, or hot. Cold is where there's no resemblance of Christianity in the home. There's no semblance of it. Nobody even knows you're a Christian. Warm is where there is some semblance of God in the home, but not too deep. Church attendance is when we get to church, it's good enough. Perhaps hot, where the gospel is being lived out each day, where there's a biblical worldview practice on a regular basis. In other words, we look at the world through the lens of the Bible. The Bible is our guideline. The Bible is a roadmap. It's our GPS. At the very least, we have to oversee and participate in the spiritual upbringing of our children. Teaching our children the ways and the Word of God starts at home. It doesn't start at the church. Jacob's children are learning to make bad decisions from watching their dad. As a result, being dysfunctional comes naturally to him. While Jacob never responds to anyone violently, as his boys do, and we're going to see that, they haven't learned how to base their decisions on the Word of God. They haven't based their decisions on faith. And this all came about because the family was in the wrong place at the wrong time. When God sends us to a particular place at a particular time, we need to heed His command, because the alternative can prove disastrous. Jacob's refusal to do what is right in regard to his family will encourage two of his sons to do something terrible in response. When God-appointed heads do not take appropriate leadership, it creates a void which is often filled sinfully. We see that the sons of Jacob and the men were grieved and they were very angry. In ancient cultures, in the ancient Middle East, culture had a strong sense of family honor. In fact, even to this day, the Muslims practice if the daughter gets violated, then they go after that person and they kill them. If the girl misbehaves, promiscuous in that kind of a society, they stone her still. So they have a huge sense of family honor, a strong sense to defend the honor of the girl. Yet the sons of Jacob not only go on to defend the family's honor in unwise and in sinful ways that gets him in trouble. Now we see that Hamor, Shechem's father, adds insult to injury by approaching Jacob with a deal. You may notice that they didn't even apologize for the rape. And in fact, they still have the girl, Dinah, in their home. Once again, this was nothing out of the ordinary for that culture. Now, can you understand why God sets up boundaries for us? And do you understand what happens to us when we cross those boundaries? God spanks us. God spanks His children. And He does so because He loves us. Try telling that to a kid when you're spanking him. Remember, it's going to hurt you more than it hurt me. Well, emotionally it does. Physically it doesn't. Parents, we tell our children all the time that we're denying them things for their own good. And yet, there are times when we act like a one marshmallow kid. How can we expect our kids to do any better? And how can Jacob expect his kids to do any better? Now, Hamor is trying to get Jacob and his family to violate their convictions by asking them to intermarry. The next step on the slippery slope comes into play as Jacob's boys come up with a plan to get even. You see, they propose to make marriages with us, to give your daughters to us, and take our daughters to yourselves. The Canaanites' proposal to marry the daughter of Jacob was a dangerous challenge to this covenant family. They also say, make marriages with us, give your daughters to us, and take our daughters to yourselves. So they wanted to intermingle. In fact, they wanted to become one. In verse 11, Shechem said to her father and her brothers, let me find favor in your eyes, and whatever you say to me, I will give. Ask me ever so much dowry and gift, and I will give according to what you say to me. But give me the young woman as a wife. In other words, name your price. In ancient cultures, a special dowry legitimized a union that had begun if there were premarital intercourse, and the bride's father had the right to ask any price he wanted as a result of that. That's why Shechem says to Jacob, name your price. In other words, we're going to make it right with money. Verse 13, but the sons of Jacob answered Shechem and Hamor, his father, and spoke deceitfully because he had defiled Dinah, their sister. And they said to them, we cannot do this thing to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised, for that would be a reproach to us. But on this condition, we will consent to you. If you will become as we are, if every male of you is circumcised, then we will give our daughters to you, and we will take your daughters to us, and we will dwell with you, and we will become one people. But if you will not heed us and be circumcised, then we will take our daughter and be gone. So the boys answer for the family, but they're deceitful in that answer. They say that would be a reproach to us. From the beginning, Simeon and Levi planned evil against Shechem and Hamor and their people. Yet they covered their evil plan with spiritual words, and they used Dinah as cover. They feel justified because the men of Shechem treated Dinah, their sister, just like they would a prostitute. But instead, they prostituted the sign of God's covenant for their own purpose, didn't they? Notice that it is in the boys that are tending to the problem. Where's Jacob? Where's dad? Where's the leader of the family? He's absent. He's quiet. He's passive. So Jacob's boys tell Hamor that if all the men of the city agree to circumcision, they agree to intermarry, essentially merging the two cultures into one, which is tragic, because they're taking something sacred, circumcision, which was a sign of their covenant with God, and they're using it as a weapon. This shows us, first of all, that our signs don't always accurately portray or give us the condition of the heart. Secondly, it shows us how we can take things that are sacred and misuse them for our own fleshly desires. Jeremiah 17:9. Some of you guys know this scripture very well. The heart is deceitfully wicked above all things. Who can know it? Folks, we have a bad heart. We don't need to go to a cardiologist to tell us that. God already has told us that. And then after all, they, Jacob's clan, are supposed to be a separate people, just as we are. And ever since God promised a coming Messiah, Satan had tried to counter that by neutralizing or killing off anyone who could belong to the promised line. And I believe Satan was behind this whole thing in trying to propose to become one people, trying to unite the Canaanites with the Israelites. They are being asked to join the world in order to acquire women, money, and a false sense of peace. Is that any different than today? Absolutely not. People leave their faith somewhere in order to acquire wealth, fame, women, and money. There's nothing new under the sun. Now watch the plan, the rest of the plan as it unfolds, because the slope gets steeper and steeper and slippery and slippery. Verse 18, and their words pleased Hamor and Shechem, Hamor's son. So the young man did not delay to do the thing because he delighted in Jacob's daughter. He was more honorable than all the household of his father. So Hamor obviously agrees with the plan, and he's pleased because he wants to marry into the family, and that's wealthy and influential. And so he agrees to be circumcised. In verse 20, and Hamor and Shechem, his son, came to the gate of the city and spoke with the men of the city, saying, these men are at peace with us. Therefore, let them dwell in the land and trade in it. For indeed, the land is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters to us as wives, and let us give them our daughters. Only in this condition would the men consent to dwell with us to be one people. If every male among us is circumcised as they are circumcised, will not their livestock, their property, and every animal of theirs be ours? Greed, right? Only let us consent to them, and they will dwell with us. And all who went out of the gate of the city needed Hamor and Shechem, his son. Every male was circumcised, all who went out of the gate of the city. It's interesting that the reason they agree for the whole city and all the males to be circumcised is because of their greed. They think they're going to have property, livestock, and every single animal of theirs is going to be ours, they said. They convinced them that it would be worth it. The potential gain of wealth made it worth it. It was all greed. They wanted Jacob's possession. Greed is an amazing motivator for people. Greed works. In the 1980s, remember that movie, Wall Street, with Michael Douglas? He said, greed is good. Remember yuppies? They were everything about money, about wealth, and the acquisition of wealth. When Beamers first appeared on the scene, remember that? I remember that 80s pretty well because I thought I was cooler than catnip at that time. Little did I know, I was not. But greed is a strong motivator. Now, we could recognize that greed syndrome in this way. There are seven signs that tells us if a person is greedy. Number one, they have overly self-centered behavior. Their behavior becomes the first giveaway of the greedy people. Greedy people are always saying, me, 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 with very little regard for the needs and feelings of others. Number two, envy. Now, envy and greed are twins. While greed is a strong desire for more and more possessions, such as wealth and power, envy goes one step further and includes a strong desire by greedy people for the possessions of others. Number three, greedy people lack empathy. People that are greedy are not concerned about the feelings of others. That's not part of their repertoire. As such, they have little qualms about causing pain to others. Their inability to empathize, their lack of genuine interest in the ideas and feelings of others, and their unwillingness to take personal responsibility for their behavior and actions makes them very difficult people to be with, very difficult people to deal with. Then number four, greedy people are never satisfied. Greedy people look at the world as a zero-sum game. A zero-sum game is when there's only winners and losers. Instead of thinking that everyone would benefit as the pie gets larger, they view the pie as a constant and want to have the biggest part. They truly believe that they deserve more, even if it comes at someone else's expense. And let me tell you, that is huge in our society today, especially amongst young people. They think the world owes them a favor. They think they need that everything should be free for them. Number five, greedy people are experts in manipulation. They are highly talented and taking credit for work done by others. They can be charming, but their principal agenda is to have people around them that feed their ego. And number six, greedy people are into the short run. They are focused on satiating their immediate needs and leave it to others to cope with the consequences. To illustrate, as leaders of corporations, they are more interested in getting their bonuses, and instead of making investments for future innovation, or to share whatever benefits accrue with their employees. Number seven, in the pursuit of their material needs, they know no limits. Greedy people are not good at maintaining boundaries. They will compromise moral values and ethics to achieve their goals. They look for loopholes or clever ways to outsmart the rules and regulations that have been put into place to moderate this kind of behavior. Greed has no respect for national origin, ethnicity, or sex. And we see that these people were very greedy. Verse 25, Now it came to pass on the third day when they were in pain that the two sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, each took his sword, came boldly upon the city and killed all the males. And they killed Hamor and Shechem his son with the edge of the sword and took Dinah from Shechem's house and went out. The sons of Jacob came upon the slain and plundered the city because their sister had been defiled. They took the sheep, their oxen, their donkeys that was in the city and what was in the field and all their wealth and their little ones and their wives they took captive and they plundered even all that was in the houses. One commentator said, cruelly performed circumcision could be quite incapacitating, particularly after 2 or 3 days. And that's what's happened to these people. They were in pain. Simeon and Levi knew. They waited until the third day when the pain was the most intense. They were more sore. They couldn't fight. They went into town and killed every single male. This was not only a brutal and deceptive act, but also disgraced God's covenant of circumcision. Simeon and Levi showed themselves to be the true children of Jacob from a bitter, competitive home. No matter how Dinah was violated, well, that was wrong. But now you can see that these guys were even more wrong. So they came in, and in the boldness which they executed their foul plan shows the hardness of their hearts. They killed every single one, and they plundered everything, including taking the surviving women and children as slaves. Nice kids, huh? Verse 30, then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, you have troubled me by making me obnoxious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites, and since I am few in number, they will gather themselves together against me and kill me. I shall be destroyed, my household and I. But they said, should he treat our sister like a harlot? One thing that is that Jacob, I don't know if you caught this, but in verse 30, here is what illustrates what Jacob is all about. It says, you have troubled me by making me obnoxious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and Perizzites, and since I am few in number, they will gather themselves together against me and kill me. I shall be destroyed, my household and I. Everything about Jacob was about me, myself, and I. The unholy trinity. Everything was about me. He was so narcissistic that everything was about him. And he's not even concerned at the fact that his daddy got raped. He's concerned as to what's going to happen to him. What are people going to say about him? How is he going to be viewed in the community? You have disgraced my name. Everything was about him. It was about his reputation. Some of you may remember the movie The Karate Kid and Mr. Miyagi. Mr. Miyagi had a quote, and he said, the best way to avoid being hit is to not be there when the punch is thrown. And so that means we shouldn't be put ourselves in bad situations. And Jacob put his family in harm's way by not going where God sent him. Dinah was probably just a teenager, and she is not to blame as to what happened to her. But what happened to her is a consequence of a bad choice by her dad. And the excuse that the two brothers gave, should my sister be treated like a harlot? Is that reason? Is that reason to kill everyone? When Jacob was about to die, he prophesied over each of his 12 sons. And this is what he said about Simeon and Levi. This is Genesis 49, verse 5. Simeon and Levi are brothers. Instruments of cruelty are in their dwelling place. Let not my soul enter their council. Let not my honor be united to their assembly. For in their anger they slew a man, and in their self-will they hamstrung an ox. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. He saw Simeon and Levi for who they were, but he rebuked them far too late. The prophetic word of God through Jacob proved true. God, in fact, both divided the tribes of Simeon and Levi and scattered among Israel. The tribe of Simeon was scattered because of their lack of faithfulness and was effectively dissolved as a tribe. And the tribe of Simeon was later on absorbed into the tribal area of Judah. On the other hand, the tribe of Levi was also scattered. But because of their faithfulness of this tribe during the rebellion of the golden calf, the tribe was scattered as a blessing throughout the whole nation of Israel, and they became the priestly line. So there was some sort of retribution for them in a positive way. So in application, what does this mean? We as parents, we need to know that our decisions have serious consequences. We as parents need to be vigilant where our kids are allowed to go. We as parents need to spend time with our kids and instill in them what the gospel is all about. And we as parents and as people of God need to live out the gospel each and every day. If it is true that we say that we are Christians, then we need to live out that gospel wherever we may be. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we come before you. We just thank you so much for your word that doesn't hide even all the bad things that have taken place. Father, I pray that whatever lesson was in store for us, I pray that if you pointed something out in our hearts, that we would make application in our lives. And Father, I pray that you allow us the privilege of sharing this gospel with the people we come in contact with. We thank you and we praise you. We ask in Jesus' name.